It is my great pleasure now to hand the podium over to Jen Hargrave from Women with Disabilities Victoria, and I'll leave all the introductions to her. Thanks, Jen.
Thank you, Robin, and I might start by saying Dara have been fantastic to work with in putting together this forum. Thank you all for coming and being part of this important and very timely discussion, and particular loads of appreciation to our panel members who have been so generous in giving part of their time in their really busy days to be here. As they've said, we've got Yang and Xenia from Berry Street Family and Children's Services, who work in the family violence team. Elisa from Women's Legal Service, Rodney from No to Violence, Diane from Barwon Centre Against Sexual Assault, or CASA, and Jackie, or Jax Brown, Disability Advocate. This is a fantastic opportunity for us to be able to speak directly with the panel, who hold a wealth of expertise in working in violence response and prevention. And I look forward to introducing them in more detail shortly, but first I think it's good if we introduce the topic and start by acknowledging that violence and abuse are really common experiences in our community. They may have affected us personally or the people we work with, and they can touch us in a range of different ways. So if you're feeling like you need to take a break at any stage, please feel free to leave the room. If you'd like to speak to someone today, three of our panel have kindly offered to speak with you during the beginning of lunchtime. And I'll ask you if you can just say hello and wave your hand. So, and can you say your names as well so people can track your voices? Sorry.
So I'm Xenia.
Yeah, I'm Yen.
And Diane as well.
Oh, Diane.
Great. And the other option is, if you're not wanting to speak to someone right now, in your information packs that you all have, there's a fact sheet, and on the back that's got contact numbers. It's good to remember that some of these numbers can be contacted in a crisis, but also you can call these numbers for confidential advice or to seek outreach. Many services provide outreach, which is a crucial service for many people with disabilities. So this year we have violence against people with disabilities has risen to the front of public consciousness through the Fairfax and Four Corners reports. In the past, our community worried about the safety of people with disabilities in public, on the street. There was that worry about stranger danger. But now our community can see the risks the people with disability face from some service providers in our homes, in our day services, in our transport and education services. And some of our members of Parliament are responding to this community awareness. We currently have an Australian Senate committee inquiry into disability abuse and a Victorian one about to begin. And we have the Victorian Ombudsman's investigation into disability abuse happening. The disability sector is interested too. We've got the National Disability Services Zero Tolerance Project and the NDIS Safeguards Consultation happening. At the very same time, there's another community awareness dawning, and this one's about violence against women. This one has many similarities. In the past, women were told to avoid strangers, but now as the media is starting to report violence against women more, and particularly family violence, we're all starting to understand that issue much more. And again, some of our members of Parliament are responding. Yesterday, Queensland Senator Larissa Waters told the Australian Senate, as she delivered her committee's interim report into domestic violence, that one in three women over the age of 15 have reported experiencing family violence in Australia. And she shared the horrific statistic that up until this year, one Australian woman a week is killed by her partner or ex-partner. And that this statistic has in fact changed this year and gone up to two women a week. And in Victoria, we have a Royal Commission into Family Violence underway. And just in matter of using terminology today, the terms domestic violence and family violence can be used interchangeably for our purposes. But while we have these two huge social issues dawning on our community's awareness, there's still something that's about disability discrimination allowing for violence against people with disabilities, and also at the same time gender discrimination allowing for violence against women. But there's one issue that still is not really at a high level of consciousness. And that's about how those two things can intersect. About how women with disabilities can, of course, experience disability-based violence, but also experience violence against women in all its forms. And that if you combine those two risk factors, the risk increases exponentially. This is not to say that men with disabilities do not experience violence, because they certainly do, and all violence is unacceptable. And we need to listen to and support anyone who does experience violence. But to be able to respond appropriately, it's important to understand the causes and to understand that disability discrimination mixes with gender discrimination just as it does with things like racism, ageism and homophobia. The most common form of violence against women is family violence, and women with disabilities do experience family violence. So it's important for the community to understand that we can't always assume that all families are a positive support. In 2014 and 13, three important and thorough studies into violence against women with disabilities were released, and the findings from them are available in a snapshot here in this position statement, which is available on the Women with Disabilities Victoria website. At the moment, we don't have a Word version on the website. PDF is searchable, but if you contact me, I can get you a copy of our Word version. These studies that I'm talking about show starkly high rates of violence against women. Despite the rates, many women who disclose violence are not believed and they're not supported. So let's talk to our panel about how women with disabilities can be believed and how they can be supported. Now, we're not short on talent here, but we are short on time. So we're going to have to move quickly and save our questions until the end. I'm going to try to keep and run a tight ship, so I'll ring a bell when it's time for each speaker to wrap up and I'll give you a minute's warning. And as a general introduction to the panel, these speakers have been chosen specifically today because they represent services that have demonstrated a commitment to providing access for women with disabilities or men with disabilities. And we've also invited Jax for many reasons. She's a prominent and well-respected disability advocate. She's had experience in providing violence prevention programs through the Women with Disabilities Victoria Gender and Disability Workforce Development Program. And because we believe that in speaking about women with disabilities, it's crucial to hear from women with disabilities. In hearing the panel presentations, let's think about what's the role of disability advocacy here? How does violence against women with disabilities fit into our work? So for our first guests, it's Yang and Xenia from Women from Berry Street, Victoria's largest child and family services. And I might let you introduce your roles if you're happy to. I'll hand it over. Thank you.
So Yen and I are from the Northern Family and Domestic Violence Service at Berry Street. We both work in our intake service, and I also do court support down at the Broadmeadows Court in Heidelberg. The Northern Family and Domestic Violence Service is part of an integrated family violence service, which in that includes the 24-hour service, which is the Safe Steps Family and Domestic Violence Response Centre. Part of that is also NCARS, which is a Northern Crisis After Hours Response Service, and that provides 24-hour face-to-face and telephone support to women who have experienced domestic violence. Berry Street specifically do intake, as I said, and outreach. We provide telephone support for the most part, and that's responding to police referrals and taking incoming calls from women who have experienced domestic violence, and secondary consultation to any services that have got clients that are identifying with experiences of family violence, and clients may also be allocated for outreach casework. Court support is also part of our integrated service. So our particular service goes to Heidelberg, Broadmeadows Court and the Neighbourhood Justice Centre in Collingwood. Over there you'll find community legal services that clients can also access and other court workers that clients can be referred to. Berry Street and Anglicare also have the mother, child and adolescent family violence counselling that clients can be referred to.
So Berry Street's practice principles, and I guess all other family violence services out there, at least in Australia, this is what the framework that we fit under. So it's the basic principle that safety from violence is a human right, that everyone deserves to be safe from violence. So our understanding is that we are a women's only service, but that's because 95% of victims or survivors of family violence are women and children. But the person, what we believe is that the person using violence is always responsible for their own actions. There is no victim blaming in the work that we do. It's it's a woman's right to stay in a relationship. Often women will say it's not the relationship that they want to leave, they just want the violence to end. Okay, so we have a lot of support services, like even the law supports that statement that everyone deserves to be safe from violence. Okay. So generally the first questions that we will ask a woman is to do a risk assessment of what's been going on for her. So we'll start from, what was the most recent incident of violence? And with women it can range between a verbal incident to more extreme physical violence. What is the worst incident of violence can indicate what the level of risk is for a woman. If it's escalating, that's also very important. And, of course, if children are present, the Family Violence Act states that exposing a child to family violence and abuse is in itself abusive. So even though it's not directed to a child experiencing that in the home is meets the definition of family violence. How safe does she feel is a really important question to ask. A woman's own assessment of her safety is the most important. And of course we use the Comprehensive Risk Assessment Framework tool, or known in our field as the CRAFT, and that asks a range of questions and gives us a snapshot of what's going on for the woman.
So within our risk assessment and working with women with disabilities, we also ask things such as, what about your health or disability? How is the abuse and violence impacting on your health? Mm-hmm. Any medical issues that can be dangerous if they're neglected? Does anyone control or change what you're trying to say? And within that, is anyone trying to take things from you, restrict your access, or restrict you from, say, leaving your home?
Yeah, these are really important questions for us to ask because, like we said, because of the volume of work that we're expected to undertake, a lot of the work that we do is over the phone. We also use the National Relay Service when that's relevant. But these questions are obviously, when we're talking to a woman over the phone, it's not immediately obvious that she has a disability. And so asking these questions are really important in engaging her risk because obviously the risk to people with disabilities can be very different.
And... Okay. So when we're speaking to anyone who's experienced domestic violence, we always want to talk to them about safety planning, which is an ongoing process. And, you know, every time you speak to a woman, their risk may have changed. So by helping them to maintain their safety, we can be a bit collaborative and speak to other people who are in their support system and speak to them about any other strategies that they have used.
Yeah,
I mean, they've already been experiencing
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
So they've already been kind of maintaining their own safety in a way, but perhaps need a few more extra tips around that.
Yeah.
Often women who are experiencing violence in the home, whether it's from a carer or otherwise, often if there is someone coming into the home to provide extra home help and things like that, those are the people who are actually in the best position to assist the woman on a day-to-day basis without having the person using violence being, you know, aware of what's going on. That obviously puts the carer or the person delivering the home care services in a precarious position, but often that is the safest way to access a woman. Okay.
So in terms of services that can be used, obviously 000 is the best service that,
yeah.
that people can call if there's a problem. Safe Steps have also got, because they're a 24-hour service, clients can be referred to crisis accommodation or refuge through there. And Berry Street, we can also make referrals to refuge.
The basis of that is that we're actually not a crisis service. We're a short-term or to long-term support service. But if a woman's in an immediate danger, she needs to call 000. Or call Safe Steps. If she doesn't want to approach the police, she doesn't have to. It might not be the safest option for her, but the Safe Steps program can provide a crisis accommodation and refuge referral. Okay, so safety planning with a disability focus. I know we're running out of time. So we have to take in consideration, we are, and all the other family violence organisations are the point of contact for women. Her own mobility and care and communication all needs to be taken into account. These aren't straightforward, and they are about what the woman needs and wants, and it's about collaborating with her about how she wants to negotiate these small hurdles. There are other ways that we safety plan with women to suit her situation, things like programming emergency numbers or talking to a friend about using a code word. So if she texts, the sun is shining today, that could often mean, I'm in danger, please call 000 for me. That might often be the easiest way or the safest way for her to get support immediately. There's obviously collaboration, like we've said again and again. It's about seeking her permission, and it's always about what she wants, about talking to external services and perhaps putting an alert on the crisis services that might be there to support her. If she has an intervention order, we don't really have time to go over those, but
we can help support her to yeah. make application and speak to the police about what's going on for her.
Yeah. Okay.
So
agency and choice. Women's are the experts of her own and children's safety. Doesn't matter if she is a woman with disabilities or not. At the end of the day, even if we don't believe she's safe, she's managed to keep herself safe until that point, and so we have to have faith that she is autonomous and that she is the best person to assess her own risk.
And so every time we do have contact with a woman who's experiencing family violence, those times are crucial to keep kind of reinforcing safety and risk and, checking in and see how it's going over time if you're having a regular contact.
Okay.
And this is our last slide. So what this speaks to, this is from building the evidence report that came out 2008, a while ago now. But one of the outcomes of that was that the most beneficial responses to women with disabilities experiencing violence is to involve strong collaborative partnerships in which expertise is shared between these and other service sectors. So it's about you working with us, working with the woman. Thank you.
We've left some of our brochures at the front there, as well as the women's health cards for the North region.
Yeah, and the DV Vic, I don't know if you guys are aware of them. So the Domestic Violence Resource Centre of Victoria has, and we've left some order forms, and they have a whole lot of different resources that you can order, as well as the Women's Health in the North, because we're a service in the North, and there's different services depending on which area of Melbourne or Victoria that you're from. But those help cards list the different courts and different family violence and crisis services in each LGA, if you...
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you so much, Yanina. Zenia, let me say too, I've seen firsthand the fantastic work that Berry Street does with women and children with disabilities. Now we'll turn our minds to legal supports, and we have Elisa, who's a senior lawyer and an outreach worker at the statewide Women's Legal Service. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Elisa. I'm the outreach coordinator at Women's Legal Service Victoria. And I'd just like to start out by talking about what our service is all about. It's a statewide community legal service, obviously for women, and we provide advice, information, referral, and in some cases representation ongoing. But we also have a legal education unit which provides legal education in terms of resources and seminars and workshops and what have you. And we also have a policy unit which works on issues in relation to women, family violence and relationship breakdown. So, the areas of law that Women's Legal Service specialise in are family law, family violence and victims of crime assistance matters before VOCAT. And we operate a telephone advice line 4 times a week, worker telephone inquiries, so any workers engaged in community support can contact our service on the phone line that I'll put up again if they've got any issue in relation to a client. So we try and assist straight away, but we guarantee that we'll get back within 24 hours if you have a client who has a legal problem in relation to one of the areas of law that we practice in. We also operate a clinic at our William Street office every Thursday morning from 9:30 to 12 o'clock, where women can just drop in for advice. And we have Link Virtual Outreach, so that's my area. That is a program that we have been developing in conjunction with family violence agencies in the north of Melbourne, Goulburn North East, and currently extending to other parts of the state, whereby we provide legal advice using Skype to family violence agencies and community health centres who assist their clients to access our advice through Skype. And it's a service that's that's, well, we hope, is expanding. We're looking for funding at the moment, but it's been a great way for us to expand our reach. And I might touch on that a little later, because we're always looking for other organisations who may wish to partner with us to provide that service to their clients in a more accessible way. We also do ongoing casework in relation to family law and family violence matters, so assisting some of the people who make contact with us on an ongoing basis whilst their legal matters are on foot. We also have a website, and the website has fact sheets that you can look at and you can download, print off, some of which I've brought along today. So I'll put some of those out for people to look at. Now, I've been asked today to look at applying for an intervention order. And the first thing you need to consider is what sort of intervention order you're talking about. So there is two acts in Victoria that deal with violence. They are the Family Violence Protection Act and the Personal Safety Intervention Orders Act. Now, I'll focus today on family violence because that's the focus of our forum today. And the first thing we need to consider is whether the parties are family members. Now, Robin has organised some written materials that I think everyone might have, and it includes the meaning of family members in relation to the Family Violence Protection Act. So when we're looking at whether a person may apply for and obtain a Family Violence Intervention Order Act, there are three main questions. Is the applicant or the AFM? So the AFM is an affected family member. Are they a family member of the respondent? The second question is, has the respondent's behaviour constituted family violence? And the third question is the respondent likely to continue to behave in this way or do so again? So you'll see that the meaning of family member is quite wide under the Family Violence Protection Act. So it includes a spouse or domestic partner or an ex-spouse or domestic partner. It includes someone who's been in previously or currently in an intimate personal relationship. It includes relatives or people who have previously been relatives. It includes a child who normally resides with the person, or a child of a person who previously did so. Intimate relationships aren't necessarily sexual relationships. It includes a person regarded as being like a family member. So that is really quite a wide definition, and the court will look at social and emotional ties. It will look at whether or not the people live together, or whether there was a reputation in the community that they were in a family-like situation. It looks at cultural recognition. It looks at the duration of the relationship or the frequency of the contact. It looks at financial dependence or interdependence. It looks at the issue of provision of care, whether it's paid or unpaid. It looks at the provision of sustenance or support. So any one of those things may bring the relationship into one that's considered a family member. So it's really a very broad definition in the Act. The Act also provides a specific example of a relationship between a person with a disability and the person's carer, which may over time come to approximate the type of relationship that might exist between family members. There's also the ability in the Act for an order to be made against a person who's the associated, who's an associate of the person who's perpetrated the violence. And the Act also says that an order can be made protecting an associate of the family member who may not be a family member themselves but who has been exposed to the family violence. So it's quite broad and it's a little bit complex, but you've got the written information there. And if you've got any questions, I'm happy to talk about that later. Oh, I should have had that up when I was talking, sorry. So, yes, looking at all these issues as to whether or not it's family-like relationship, certainly not what, you know, the traditional idea of a family is, much, much broader. And specifically in drafting the Act, the issue of carers and disabled people was one of the issues that the Parliament sought to cover in the Family Violence Protection Act. Oh, yeah, I'm not very good at this part. Okay, so next I'd like to look at the second step of whether or not there's been family violence. So as with family members, the definition of family violence is very wide as well. It covers physical or sexual abuse, it covers emotional and psychological abuse, it covers economic abuse. The Act goes into quite a lot of detail about what might be economic abuse, but it includes things like coercing a person to relinquish control of their finances. It includes things like disposing of someone's property or jointly owned property against that person's wishes and without a lawful excuse. It includes things like preventing access to joint financial assets for meeting household expenses, preventing someone from seeking or keeping employment, coercing a person to sign a power of attorney, coercing a person to sign a contract for finances or for goods and services or for a contract of guarantee. So economic abuse is, within the Act, very, very wide, and that includes also any other threatening, coercive or controlling and dominating behaviour. Now, in relation to... In relation to children, as Zenya and Yang touched on, if children have heard or witnessed or been exposed to the effects of family violence, they can be covered by an intervention order, and if there is a child in the household, the court must look at whether or not those children need children in the household need the protection of the family violence order. I need to be quick. So that includes things like the police coming after an incident. The children may be traumatised by that. The children may be traumatised by seeing a site that needs cleaning up after an incident. And also, the other issue that I wanted to touch on there was things like intentionally damaging property, intentionally hurting an animal, depriving a person of their liberty, or any other sort of controlling offence. It doesn't need to be criminal. It doesn't need to be criminal behaviour at all. So next, the intervention orders can be sought by police, or people can seek an intervention order from the magistrates' court themselves. They can seek orders which prevent the other party from doing all these things up there, including being at the home even though they have ordinarily lived at the home. They can be prevented from coming to the home. They can be prevented from coming near workplaces, from schools of children. They can be prohibited from any telephone or contact whatsoever, other sort of postings on internet, etc., or getting anyone else to do so. So getting a bit... a breach of an intervention order is a serious criminal offence, and the courts do treat it very seriously. They commonly deprive, you know, imprison people for breaching an intervention order. The police, according to the code of conduct, must act on a breach of an order, and if they don't do so, it's really important that you're aware that you can contact the police, Vic Police Family Violence Liaison Officers, who are at all the 24-hour stations and who will assist to ensure that that is done if it's not done first off. All right, I had lots of other things to say, but I think I'd better close. I have brought along, as I said, some fact sheets. I've also brought some cards, which I'm happy for you to take away, which have details of our phone advice service and our clinic. Okay, and just a last plug for our Link Virtual Outreach. If anyone would be interested in talking about partnering with our organisation to bring clients legal advice via Skype, I'd be very happy to talk to you.
Thank you, Elisa, for that really important information. Elisa touched on the Personal Safety Act. Now, where that's relevant is if you're needing an intervention order for a relationship that's not family-like. And if you're interested in looking that up, I encourage you to Google it. It's easy to find, and it's actually quite easy to read for a piece of legislation. It's plain English. And I've seen that used between residents in shared accommodation as well. Now let's turn our minds to sexual assault. We have here Diane, who's a counsellor advocate at Barwon Casa. Thank you, Diane.
Hello again. Well, the good news is I had time to go into work and print out my PowerPoints, which each of you have a copy. The not so good news is I left the memory stick sitting in my computer, and I decided that it wasn't worth going back for it in case I missed my train, because I work in Geelong. We are Barwon Centre Against Sexual Assault, and we've got offices in both Geelong and Horsham. So we cover the Wimmera area as well as in Geelong and the surrounding areas. So just a little bit about Barwon Casa. Firstly, have most of you heard of CASAs? It always interests me. I get quite a few nods. We do a lot of public speaking around the place, and sometimes people are very familiar with Centre Against Sexual Assaults or CASAs, and sometimes they're not so. So hopefully it's okay if I tell you a bit about it, even if you've heard it before. So CASAs themselves are everywhere, are covered in Victoria, and we're nearly predominantly funded by the Department of Health and Human Services now. And some of the different CASAs, some do sexual assault only, and some do, as is the case of Barwon Casa, we do both family violence and sexual assault services. So just a bit about Barwon Casa. We've been operating since 1978, and as we've heard from the previous speakers, our work is on every level is based on gendered stress, being gendered and strength-based, and we do, within counselling, do a lot of work from trauma therapy kind of guidelines. What the gendered stuff means is, as we've mentioned before, we know that most violence occurs in the family home, and most violence is perpetrated by men against women. We know that's a generalisation, but that's certainly what the figures hold up. We are a victim-only service, so even though we do see men, if we come to know that they're actually perpetrating violence against women or children, we won't see them within our building. And that's partly because we want our buildings to be safe places for victims, and we want to take a strong stand against violence by men. As we've heard before, we also kind of look into that structural... We kind of have that structural belief about violence, that most of it is around power and control, and that certainly affects both men and women, but particularly women, and as the reports that have been cited before, particularly women with disabilities, often have more... the effects of power and control can come into their lives from many different forms. We've got 17 counsellors. I'm one of them, mostly part-time or close to full-time. We come from all kinds of disciplines. So I'm a social worker, but we've got psychologists and people from different disciplines. And we also do our own after-hours service, so we have people on roster every night of the week. So if there's a sexual assault in Barwon or Wimmera, somebody will attend the hospital to support the person who has been recently assaulted. CASA themselves have got a statewide... after-hours service that you can ring 24 hours a day to get information about what you might do to help somebody either who has been assaulted recently or a long time in the past. I've given... Outside there's these little green cards, which on the back... I know they're in really small font and I apologise for that, but all the CASAs across the state... and their phone numbers are listed on there. There's also a CASA forum website that you can access that information. At Barwon CASA and quite a few other of the CASAs across the state, we also work with children who have, in our jargon we call it, are displaying problem sexualised behaviours. So that is the children who, we work with people under 15. If they're sexually acting out against other children, we will kind of run therapeutic diversion programs to try and stop that from occurring. We also, as I mentioned, do counselling for family violence for women and children under 16. That's to do with our funding source. We do know that men also experience family violence, but for us, that's what the funding guidelines state. As I've mentioned, we do quite a lot of secondary consultation, and I am, myself and a couple of other people, are predominantly on intake, and we would take sometimes 3, sometimes 6 phone calls a day from different agencies or schools or parents or, from anywhere asking about a situation in relation to sexual assault or family violence, and we guide people as to whether it's worth them making a referral for counselling or whether they might like to go off to the crisis care component within Barwon is run by Minerva Family Services, so we'll send people there for the crisis response in relation to family violence. Or any other referral. So feel free to ring either our CASA or other CASAs for that kind of specific information to do with your own circumstance. We also run what's called the SAPS program, which is Sexual Assault Prevention Program in secondary schools. That program was actually first written by CASA House, which is another CASA. But we have adopted that last year in a pilot program to be running special schools, because one of the things that we've learnt along the way is sometimes students, participating in special school or alternative education need a bit more clarified ways of learning about particularly consent. One of the things that we know about the children who do sexually offend against other children is it's often to do with they're not really understanding consent, or they're not really picking up cues about what might be okay or not okay. So that's what that program is designed to do. Based at Year 9, we have different schools that we target each year, and certainly that program's run in many Melbourne and regional schools as well. Let me see. I've talked about the CASA Forum, the peak body, and I think has been mentioned before. I won't go into like too many of the stats about what we know about sexual assault, but figures that are often used is that one in three women are survivors of childhood sexual abuse. And so one of our slogans is, one in three women are survivors of childhood sexual abuse. We are grandmothers, mothers, sisters, daughters, partners, cousins, friends. Listen, believe, make our journey easier. The youngest person I've worked with at Bowen Casa, and I've been a counsellor there for 8 years, is 4, and the oldest person is 91. So, and the woman that I worked with who was 91 had actually been assaulted when she was a child, but moved into a residential setting and was sexually assaulted again. And what we find often happens in those circumstances is past childhood sexual abuse is re-triggered. So we did a few sessions around that, not only in terms of counselling, but also in terms of advocacy, because she was really fearful about with the different carers that came in to shower, what might happen. So it was important that she was able to talk with the management of the residential facility about what might help her feel safer. So even though we're counsellors, we're also advocates around people's rights as well. I'm looking at the time, and I'm really aware of that time is brief, but I just wanted to mention that at Barwon Casa and across some of the other casas, we're what's called an MDC. So now we are co-located with the SOCCET, which is the Sexual Offences and Child Investigation Team. So part of this collaboration that I'm sure lots of you will have heard, comes into a lot of policy, is the idea is that we get co-located with the police who investigate sexual offences and also the child protection staff who investigate allegations of sexual offences against children. And in July will be 2 years that we've been co-located, and I can just say it's absolutely fantastic. I've learnt so much about better ways to help people in that process. So we still have people can come to us and have confidentiality around their counselling matters, but if we sign consent, then we can really advocate far more quickly and far more fairly and consistently for our clients. Just in terms of disability support, I'm not sure if most of you are aware, but if somebody's making a statement in relation to a sexual assault, they have a disability, they can elect to have an independent third party present during the making of the police statement and if it goes to court. Their role is simply to make sure that the process is being fair and that the client themselves is understanding what's being said and what's being asked of them. And also people with disability for indictable offences, so for more serious offences, can make video statements that are later used in court. That also applies to children making statements about sexual offences. That's called VAR, which is video and audio recording evidence, which basically means we've just got a little room that's all nicely set out with the camera, and people's statements are filmed as well as recorded. We go, obviously our buildings are accessible and we do a lot of outreach, but I think most of the CASAs are the same, so if you're ever thinking that you want to come to a CASA and you're not sure that about accessibility, we will go right out of our way to make sure that people's individual needs are met. So, you know, feel free to contact us. Just in terms of stats, so last year we had 888 cases of sexual assault, both people either coming in relation to past sexual assault or recent sexual assault, and in our services 15.7% of those were people with a disability. We've broken them down there, so that is indicative of that people with disabilities are being, that violence against people with disabilities is probably higher than the general public. So that's us. We're in Geelong. The contact numbers are there. And please take all my brochures because they were quite heavy to carry up, so I don't want to have to carry them back. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane, and what a fantastic example of a sexual assault prevention program where it's been tailored to be specific for students with disabilities. And that Nelson Park Special Developmental School Prevention Program actually involved the whole school, so the principal and teachers and parents were involved in that curriculum as well. Because we started a bit late and we've got such a jam-packed, fantastic panel, we're running a little bit behind time. Our next speaker's very kindly offered to truncate his talk, which is unfortunate because it's really important, but we might be able to find out other ways to hear more from Rodney, and we'll look at how time allocation is going as we head towards question time. But yeah, you might be starting to think we've spoken a lot about people who experience violence, but starting to wonder who is using violence, who chooses to use it, and who do they choose to use it against. Rodney's fantastic to speak on this topic. He works for No to Violence as the manager there. Thanks, Rodney.
Thank you, Jen, Robin, and everyone. I'll be really brief because I know time is marching away. And I'll just really leave you with a few brief points. So I represent a couple of services, and the men's referral service is a service I'll talk more about right towards the end. But I think the thing that I really wanted to stress is that when a man uses violence, and the majority of people who use violence in an intimate relationship are men, if we look at the proportion of people who use violence against any family member, it's 80 or 85% are men. But when we look at the proportion of people who use violence against a current or former intimate partner, it's more up the 90 to 95% range. Men use violence deliberately. It's not because of a man feeling out of control, blowing his fuse, getting too angry, feeling powerless. It's not because of stress or financial problems or relationship issues. You know, so many people, men and women, experience these things. It's what the man chooses to do when he has that intense emotion of anger or jealousy, or when he's feeling frustrated or powerless or whatever. It's that choice that he makes. And unfortunately, because of the privilege that as men we still have in relation to women, many of us men choose to focus really on our own needs, our own feelings, and to use violence as a way of feeling better and to control a partner. And that's where the different forms of violence that Elise and others talked about, around the emotional, verbal, social, physical, sexual violence, they're all tactics. They're all ways of men being able to keep things the way that they want to in their particular relationships, and they all link together. It might be the social violence to try to isolate his current or former partner so that she doesn't speak to any other men that he might have a reaction of jealousy. Well, it's his problem of jealousy. It's not her fault. She's just wanting to follow a basic human right to have social connection. But he has a jealousy reaction. He doesn't see it as himself having a problem. He then tries to close her down and blames her for his emotion. He may use emotional violence to call her worthless. He may use physical violence to make her too afraid. So their choices are different tactics of violence. And alcohol, stress, relationship issues, that's not the root of the problem, because basically it comes down to his choices. And for women with disabilities, many men who use violence have that extra layer of privilege. And their tactics to create vulnerability, to control, to trap, to terrorise, to make it too difficult for someone to exercise their choices in life. And so for women with disabilities who have the double oppression of facing disablism, as well as what it means to be a woman in our society, men can take advantage of that vulnerability and use tactics to control. So as advocates, as practitioners, as community services workers, you know, you'll come across men who are making those choices to take advantage of that potential vulnerability. So I think the last thing that I wanted to leave you with is that if you know of a situation where a man is using violence, it can be tricky. It can be difficult to know what to do. I'll leave some brochures at the back for a service that we operate called the Men's Referral Service. And it's a telephone-based service. And about 20% of our calls, 20-30%, are either from community service workers, friends, family members, colleagues, where you can talk over a situation and you can say, you know, someone I'm supporting, someone I'm advocating for, I think she's experiencing violence from a carer, from an intimate partner. Or it may be someone you're supporting who, a man who you think might be using violence. And well, what do I do? How can I do something safe here? I don't necessarily just want to barge in and have that conversation with him, because that might make it worse. I don't know what she's thinking. I don't know what's going to be the best to support her. So often it's a bit of a plan. And sometimes in addressing a situation, it might be two or three advocates, allies, friends. One person might try to find a safe way of hearing her perspective, letting her know about services, believing her, listening to her, linking her into a service like Berry Street. And then there might be the decision about, well, who's going to have that conversation with him to encourage him to call a men's referral service, or to try to encourage him to go to a men's behaviour change program, because often it's not anger management that's going to work. That can do it harm. It's not relationship counselling, because men can use it as an excuse to say, hey, love, we've got a relationship problem here, whereas really he's the one that needs to accept responsibility for his choices. So often the men's behaviour change program is the best referral choice. But to begin with, a phone call to the men's referral service, you can have an anonymous conversation with a practitioner just to talk it through about what might be some of the steps and options here about doing this safely and what other services and people can be supports there. So I'll leave some brochures at the back table for that. Okay, I think I might leave it at that, and with question time, might move over to Jen. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rodney, for both unveiling some of those myths and also for giving us some really constructive strategies to move forward when we're faced with difficult situations, when we can see men using violence against women. Now, Jackie Brown, disability advocate, who's going to speak to us about a woman's perspective on what services can offer, specifically advocacy services.
Yeah, can everybody hear me? I'm not going to get up and stand up there because I think standing's a bit overrated. And I'm not going to be too apologetic about going a little bit over time, because I think as women with disabilities, often, as we know, our voices are excluded in these kind of spaces. So I'm just going to take up a bit of time and space unapologetically, if that's okay. So I guess a lot of this has been touched on, and I haven't been being rude and sending text messages or playing games on my phone while the speakers have been talking. I've been trying to take notes in my notes section of my phone. So a lot of this stuff has been touched on, and I'll go through some of it quickly, but I think it's worth highlighting that we know for the general population that one in three women have experienced sexual abuse, And we know for women with disabilities particularly, this is at least 2 times greater than that. So for women with intellectual disability, for example, 90% have experienced sexual abuse by the time they turn 18 years of age. So that is a horrible statistic. But I think for me, knowing that, that encapsulates why we need to act, why we need to start thinking deeply about how to support women with disabilities, because we're dealing with a traumatised population and a population that needs tailored kind of advocacy and self-advocacy services. So I had 2 questions that Jen posed for me today, and the first one was, what do women with disabilities require from an advocacy service? I think they require the advocate to pick up on the signs of violence and to make appropriate referrals. And as one of the first speakers said, we need to be able to have services that provide advocacy or provide assistance or provide crisis intervention across a range of services, because we know as women with disabilities we live complex and interesting lives. We are not just our disability, we are not just our gender, we are mothers, we are carers, we are all kinds of people, and so the services that we need when we're in crisis or when we've experienced abuse or violence need to reflect those multiple roles and those multiple worlds that we straddle. And also we need advocates to really check their assumptions around what it means to live with a disability and check their assumptions around the idea or the agency that a woman with a disability might have. I think that one of the things we know about women who experience violence is that women who experience violence do things every day to keep themselves and their children safe. They do things every day to survive, to self-advocate, to look after themselves. And we know that that is also very true of women with disabilities. So seeing a woman with a disability as a vulnerable woman, that is true. She experiences a range of disadvantages and discriminations, but she also does a number of really important and powerful things in her life every day to resist that that discrimination and those forms of violence that she may be experiencing as well. So she's not just a passive, poor, weak kind of person. She is also a very enraged and powerful woman as well. And I think that often gets lost. And then my second question was, come back notes. My second question was, what does being treated with respect and given a choice mean for you? And I sat with this question for a couple of days, and I thought about it, because it was kind of confronting. I think, as someone who lives with multiple marginalised identities, obviously I'm a woman, with a disability, and I'm also gay. And often when you live with multiple forms of disadvantage, these questions around what would it feel like to have a choice or to be treated with respect are often things that you find difficult to consider, because often you're so used to not being asked those questions, and we're so used to expecting the baseline or being grateful for the very little that we're given. So I kind of sat with that and I thought about it. And I thought about it particularly in relation to the NDIS, because I've just been at the National Disability Summit in Melbourne, which was rather hard to get into as a person with a disability. Interestingly, I won't go into that, but yeah, there's a lot of space for service providers and not very much space for disability advocates or self-advocates at the moment in those kind of summits, which is rather disturbing. Anyway, so I've been thinking about that. And I think one of the things that being given choice and respect means is it means being given platforms like this, being allowed into spaces to actually have a voice. It means making sure that materials or information are presented to the woman in a way that she understands. And also, when we talk about advocacy, we need to think about as well to advocate alongside the woman. So as much as possible, to understand what she wants and needs and requires, to slow down maybe, to sit down beside her, to really check in with her and see how she wants to proceed with whatever the advocacy is. So to really advocate alongside and encourage her self-advocacy skills and connection to community and to the disability community as well. And I think one of the interesting things that's happening with the NDIS at the moment, I heard a parent of a son who had a disability speaking at the conference, and she said, you know what's really interesting is, she's in one of the trial sites, and she said, what's really interesting is within the first year, we didn't really know what we could ask for. We were so used to getting the bare minimum of services that we were finally kind of, we were talked to in these ways of choice and respect and control over the services you get, and we didn't really know how to start to think about what we even wanted because we were never really asked those questions. But now we're starting to see, a year on, that people with disabilities in those trial sites are actually asking for a whole range of different things and asking for really what they do want and starting to work through what that means. So I think, I think creating spaces and creating time and space to sit with a woman with a disability and allow her to really think that through clearly and to realise that she does actually have choices and she is being engaged with in a truly respectful manner. We'll start to kind of follow through with what it means to actually get services that are respectful and do actually allow us to have choices. That's it, the end.
Fantastic, Jax. Thank you for that. And I think from having seen the panel, we can see that there's a few more options presented to us. We might like to say to a woman, would you be interested in taking out an intervention order? Would you be interested in speaking to a centre against sexual assault? Robin's just leaving, but before she goes, she's getting the roving mic. So you'd like to do question time? Yes. Okay.
Amy, can I give you one?
Amy's going to be our microphone rover.
And I'll be the spare, but you need to direct me where to go.
We can play Marco Polo. Does anyone have a question?
Hi, it's Kathy Barakas again. Just wanted to ask the gentleman from the Men's Referral Service, sorry I didn't get your name, Rodney, thank you, just how extensive your service reach actually is. Like, how do your services get known? How do you market your services, basically?
How's that as volume? Is that okay for people to hear? Yep. So I guess with the Men's Referral Service itself, it's probably no more in some pockets than others. So I think for many people here, it might be the first time that it's heard of. I think for the Men's Behaviour Change programs, they're becoming more widely known because basically the Men's Referral Service is a referral point to the Men's Behaviour Change programs. For men who use violence against someone they're caring for, an intimate partner, another family member, it needs to be often the face-to-face work over a period of time. And that includes men themselves with disabilities, and some men with disabilities do participate in programs as well with additional supports. So there are about 35 men's behaviour change programs through Victoria, about 18, 19 within the Greater Melbourne metropolitan area, and the remainder in different rural regions. And so finding the nearest men's behaviour change program, you can do that through finding a men's referral service, but also most women's family violence services, community legal services, etc., would know where the local service is. So by all means, some men will get referred by a service or go directly to the men's behaviour change program. For others, it's finding MRS, men's referral service, as an initial step.
Thank you.
Yeah, hello. That was a great presentation. Thank you, everyone. So we work with young people with disabilities, and this is the thing that always comes to our attention, is that people are very dependent on others for quite basic supports or care. So obviously if you're dependent on someone else for, you know, your basic needs, how do you then get to a point where you say, well, that person that's providing all that stuff is perpetrating violence against me, and how do I get out of that situation when there's no funding or no other avenue for having that basic assistance provided? I recall that the previous government introduced some kind of funding that was attached to the instances of violence. Is that funding still available, or are there other avenues for people to get basic support needs?
I can jump in there.
In that kind of situation.
The information packs have got the contact information for the Department of Health and Human Services Disability Family Violence Crisis Response Initiative brokerage funding. Very long title. That's 13 weeks of brokerage funding for disability support for women and children with disabilities seeking safety from family violence. Obviously, in the longer term, because 13 weeks is very short, other strategies are required. There's a range of other funding and housing services that sexual assault and family violence services can tap into. And the Department of Health and Human Services tries to link people who go through that brokerage fund to more ongoing disability supports. I guess the question for the sector is, how can we advocate for a place for that family violence brokerage funding as we get nationalised funding as well? Was there anything anyone wanted to add on that?
I just also want to add that the funding itself is, there's quite a lot there. So I think it's about $9,000 over that 13 weeks, and it can be used in any way, whether it's equipment that she needs to self-support herself in the home, or if it's safe accommodation, whether it's a motel, hotel, or getting into refuge and providing physical access to that service, yeah.
Yeah, there's some elasticity around the amount of funding provided. I guess the thing that is quite rigid is that it's only you're only eligible if you meet the Disability Act definition of disability, which, as we know, leaves out many, many people. Any other questions?
Yeah. One of the big issues that I see for women to recognize that they are subject to abuse and violence, and I believe that they need to be support out there to support women in the process of recognition. I would like to know from you, do you do anything to support women to recognize their situation? Thank you.
Do you do anything to support women who, what was the last part of the question? Who recognize
recognize and to acknowledge that they are subject to abuse and violence.
Would Barry Street or Bowen Castle be able to take that one?
Yeah.
I think that's a really good point that you're raising, that often women don't acknowledge that what they're living in is they're living with violence. And often that's to do with, you know, women just get so worn down by what's happening to them that they just often lose sight of what would be considered to be healthy relationships, and, you know, their self-esteem gets really worn down within that. There's lots of agencies that will work with women, including ours. Like, we will work with people who choose to stay. The only reason that we might think differently to that would be if we consider the children to be at risk of harm, because obviously there's, you know, we've got to look after the safety of children. But yeah, we've got very broad views on what, you know, if the women are in that situation and don't want to leave, and they often don't, then we will work at how to better keep them safe and perhaps building up their self-esteem, and maybe considering further down the track, hopefully the guys might go off to a men's behaviour change. We're not coming from that place of, if you're getting hurt and you're not leaving, we won't work with you. And hopefully other agencies do that too.
Yeah, certainly our agency works in the same way. You know, that is about giving women choice and an agency around their situations. And often you will find that they might not be recognising certain parts of their experience of domestic violence. And so part of that is educating them around what is violence and what is not, and again, you know, providing them with safety planning around that.
And I think also for women with disabilities, we know from the Voices Against Violence report, which Women with Disabilities Victoria put out last year, and it's been touched on today, but I think it's worth reiterating, that women with disabilities experience disability-based violence as well. So particular violence that targets their disability as a site of violence. So in that report, there was one quite harrowing example that really stuck with me as a wheelchair user, where the perpetrator of violence actually removed a wheel off the woman's wheelchair so she couldn't then leave the house. So gender and disability really do intersect in women with disabilities' experience of violence, and particularly violence in the home. And also, as someone who doesn't work in the sector, but as somebody, because as we know, women's experience of violence is so high, as someone who's had to support friends who've been in violent relationships, I think we all need to learn and be supported to learn ways of beginning to speak to our friends and family members about have they experienced violence, or are they experiencing violence? Because for me, when the first time I had to try and have that conversation with someone I loved, it was really, really hard. I didn't know how to use any language around it. And sometimes the language that we learn through the sector can sound really kind of, I'm sitting you down for this kind of conversation, and people can have a bit of a reaction to that. So kind of thinking through, how do we actually start to talk to women about this might be something you might be experiencing, when I've seen behaviours like this in other people. For me, this kind of could suggest that maybe you're going through a tough time with your partner what does that mean, or just something. Yeah.
I think that's a really good point you've raised, Christian, and, I think that the lack of access to information about what constitutes violence that people with disabilities receive really highlights the need for more prevention programs and for services to be able to make that information on what is violence and how to get help available to people. I think we have time for one last question, just to sneak one in.
My question is about the legal system and the court system. When it comes, you talk about the definition of family violence, yet in my experience in supporting victims of family violence, that the intervention order process doesn't recognise most of the definitions of family violence, as in emotional abuse. I've been repeatedly told, nope, can't get it unless it's physical. So I just find, and also if, to get legal representation, most lawyers, their personal lawyers won't do it. They have to access the on-duty lawyer, which, again, in my experience, has been inadequate because they're too rushed and they don't have enough of a picture of the client and their situation.
Okay, I think that's one for me.
Yeah.
Well, I guess what I outlined before is what the Act says. To actually get an order and to satisfy the magistrate, obviously that has to be argued and they have to be satisfied that that particular type of violence has occurred. But that's what should happen, and that is, I think, what our service would hope, that if someone came to us and they have evidence that that type of violence has occurred, then we would argue that in front of the court. And as you all know, the system is stretched, and I guess what you've touched on is when applicants go down to the local magistrate's court, if they're applying for themselves, there are 50 other people at least who are in the same boat on that morning. And unfortunately, duty lawyer services, applicant support services are absolutely stretched. But that doesn't mean that the law should be applied correctly. And I guess what we need to do is make sure that the cases are adequately put before the magistrates, and the magistrates have to find if they are satisfied that that has happened, that order should be made. So I guess there's a couple of things here with many family violence orders these days. They are taken out by police, and the police are the ones who are prosecuting the cases. If it's people who are advocating on their own and applying themselves, yes, it's really important to have representation, and yes, it is. It can be difficult to get that, but all I can do is encourage people to contact services like ourselves if they are perhaps not the absolutely clear physical sexual violence. Perhaps that's an instance where people should be trying to access services like ourselves in that first instance of getting the initial first interim order. That's what I would encourage people to do, because the law is really clear. What can happen on a first mention date in an intervention order matter is that there can be some negotiations. And I guess what we need to be careful of is that clients aren't or applicants aren't persuaded to take a lesser undertaking or something like that. That the matter does get before the court, so that the magistrate can hear the evidence, and then the decision needs to be made in accordance with the Act. So I guess all I can say is that I would encourage people to get legal assistance. And yes, the system is stretched. Duty lawyers on the day are inundated with people. It is always better if you can get that advice beforehand.
Thank you, Elisa. Mm-hmm. In closing, I'd like to ask you to think as advocates going forward how you can hold those two ideas of gender and disability. So when you're working with people with disabilities, when you're making submissions to the inquiries that we've mentioned, such as the NDIS safeguards, in your discussions this afternoon. And please join me in thanking our fantastic panel of speakers.